Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Vice President of the James Beard Foundation. And every Wednesday morning at 11 from Roberta's here in Bushwick, Brooklyn, we have an interesting conversation about taste. Actually, it's more often about food, but today it's really going to be about taste, I think, because my guest is Adam Gopnik, a beloved writer at The New Yorker and author very recently of a wonderful book that's a collection of essays about taste and food and really the culture of eating. The table comes first. Welcome to the show. Welcome to Bushwick.
Thank you, Mitchell. It's good to be in Bushwick. Yeah. I say that because I'm one of those horrible Manhattanites. Remember that New Yorker cover? Showed the man and woman, the naked Adam and Eve, being exiled from Manhattan to Brooklyn.
Yes, exactly.
I have a little of that prejudice still implanted in me.
Well, then we're doubly glad that you're here. I know one of the excuses we get to get people out here is that we say you can come to Roberta's, and everyone's heard about it and wants to check it out, and
including me.
Yeah, it's the pizza before the guest. So, I'd love to just get right into it. I loved your book. I loved your book because it's things that I think about all the time and that we talk about here every Wednesday. I want to get into this first idea that you present that, you know, we think of the old Latin saying, I guess that's a redundancy, there's no disputing taste, but you think that every taste is an argument, or you say throughout the book that taste is about argument. Can we talk about that?
Sure, of course. I mean, one of the first things I say, and there's a long chapter, is, you know, about taste, which is actually adapted from a lecture I gave, mm-hmm. Long lecture. The first thing that you think about when you think about taste, simplest taste, the taste of anchovies, sardines, whatever it is that it's a thing on your palate. It tickles your palate one way or another. It has certain chemical and physiological characteristics. But that instantly we make it into what I call a moral taste. We make every mouth taste into a moral taste.
Right.
And that's, in a sense, why you and I are sitting here. Because if human beings didn't do that, we wouldn't have a subject. If we just ate the way we breathe, let's say,
right?
Where it's a necessity to us, but we don't turn our breathing into a morality very often. We don't say, you breathe through your left nostril, I believe you should only breathe on the weekends through your mouth, and so on.
I breathe more intensively than you.
Yeah, well, food is just as natural and necessary as that.
Right.
We have to eat. And yet every human group that anyone has ever known or written about or studied has intense rules about moral taste, the right way to eat, the wrong way to eat. It runs from things like keeping kosher, stuff you absolutely cannot eat without offending God, to things that we're not even aware of sometimes, like what part of the animal we'll eat, what we find disgusting. We won't eat monkey guts, but we will eat monkey loin or pig loin. So we live, our universe of taste is structured by this kind of morality. And one of the things I wanted to do in the book is articulate it a bit, because we're not always aware of it. We know, you know, Brillat Savarin, the guy who really invented the kind of gastronomic writing that we both love, said, you are what you eat. And the sort of theme of the book is, I think, is actually we eat what we are. We use our food as a way of symbolically expressing our beliefs. Now, in a comic way, we're aware that every time you go out to dinner, immediately when you get the first course that somebody is serving you, you know exactly what their politics are. You know exactly where they stand on the whole thing. If somebody gives you an organic carrot that was grown, and they tell you it was grown 5 miles from here by their friend, the farmer Mitchell, and it's served with a little fleur de sel, you know the whole story. You know that they're very sincere, Obama-supporting, Alice Waters-inspired lefties. If they take a little turn on it, I was talking about this with someone the other day, if they do the carrot and they do it, let's say, with a mock Ritz cracker that they've baked themselves, then they have a little bit more, then they have a slightly different turn on the whole thing, right? So we know people's, where people stand socially by their, how they turn their mouth tastes into moral tastes. I give an example in the book. My parents, were university professors. They weren't poor people, but they were far from wealthy. But they felt it was incumbent on them to get over to France as often as they could.
Okay.
This is something college professors of that period did, to go and eat, to taste the new one-star places. Now, they were food crazy, it's true, but it was also a way of extending their identity. That was
right.
defining who they were. Just a way of choosing pleasure in France over pedantry and German, and also in a way of escaping their own immigrant Jewish backgrounds and all of those things. I would be a little bit, not embarrassed exactly, but I would find that a little bit sort of, you don't have to do that.
Right.
Our generation, much more likely to say, oh, I went to Spain and I tasted the Blackfoot pig's right nostril.
Or came to Brooklyn even.
Yeah, or came to Brooklyn right. and did this. So at every moment in life, we're using our food to make a statement about ourselves. And that's what I mean by moral taste. And this is the tricky part, mm-hmm. Mitchell, and this is the thing I sometimes have a hard time articulating to people, because people, for some reason, have a hard time counting to two. That is, you say, one, all of our tastes are moral tastes of that kind, and they change all the time. They're mutable. They alter. Right. My parents love food, but their moral taste is different from sure. mine. And then when you say that, people think, oh, so what you mean is everything is a fad, everything is a fashion, so you should mock it all. It's like that book about, you know, the state of arugula, right?
Right.
That
right.
we only do that. And what I'm saying is, no, that's not the case at all. I think those tastes matter hugely. I structure my life around right. those tastes. I believe in them very deeply, but I don't believe in them because I think that they're natural, fixed, and unchanging, and that you and I have suddenly stumbled on the right way to eat after thousands of years right. of people eating. Now we know the right way to eat, and we need to proselytize for it. It's possible. In fact, it's necessary to be, and as I say this in the book, to have a certain kind of ironic detachment from our tastes and still be completely committed to them as an expression of who we are and who we want to be. And it's that doubleness mm-hmm. is, I think, the theme of the book, and is also, I think, in a certain way, a little bit challenging for people sometimes, because we live our lives most often torn between there's the right and natural way to have a baby, raise a child, mm-hmm. prepare dinner, or there's a fake, fashionable, artificial way to do it.
Right.
And the point of the book really is that's not the real choice. Everything we do in one way is artificial, but it's only by engaging in that kind of artifice that we find a path to pleasure.
Hmm. Fascinating. It strikes me as you discuss this idea of moral taste that we're in a moment now where perhaps the morality of the current taste resonates in so many broader ways. As you said, you know, if you serve a certain thing, it means you vote a certain way. It reflects, you know, your knowledge of Portland and perhaps you what you believe in nutrition. And it's, this food has permeated so many other things in a funny way right now that it seems even more tied to a projection or a performance of who we are than perhaps ever.
Exactly,
in some ways.
Exactly. And that's why I wanted to do this book right now. Mm-hmm. Exactly, because, I mean, I love to eat and I love food and I've been writing about it for a long time. But this moment, right now, mm-hmm. beginning of the 21st century, is a time when, more than any other time I can think of, certainly in America, food doesn't just symbolize attitudes we have about lots of other things, but it's kind of our key symbolic means. Mm-hmm. I was talking to Jeff Gordonier from The Times, and he was saying food for him feels now like what rock and roll was in the late 60s, in the sense that the quickest way to communicate your values is to say what you listen to, or was to say what
right.
you listen to then. Quickest way to communicate your values for a lot of people now is to say what you eat, what you like
where
to
you
eat.
Shop,
right? Where you shop. It's no accident, right, that where Jackie Kennedy in the early 60s would communicate the Kennedys' values by redecorating the White House. Michelle Obama now communicates the Obamas' value by changing the way the garden of the White House
right.
is. I had the fun of actually going to the White House in the course of reporting this book mm-hmm. and visiting with the great Bill Yassas, the great dessert chef there. Mm-hmm. And they have the kind of the light in their eyes and the you know, the snap in their step that comes from people who know that they're doing very significant work, because they're part of they're like the decorators were in the White House in 1960, or the cooks right. in the White House are like
right.
now.
Meanwhile, the chef then was French.
Exactly. Is, right. Well, no, exactly. That's right. a very good point, right? The chef then was French. You didn't think twice about it. You just said, oh, and we'll get a classy French chef, and he'll do all that stuff that nobody likes and nobody can pronounce, but the stuff that you have to do. So, yeah, that's why I wanted to do this book now, because food carries those larger meanings more than I think anything else we have. And with that, of course, means that it carries a lot of problems with it, because we don't have just one food culture, but many.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I think is really interesting is that we spend a lot of time these days talking about developing taste in our children, and I think sometimes we forget that adult tastes change also. I mean, a little bit further to what you were saying, that we presume that what we have right now is progress from something that was before us, and that what we like and what we do is sort of who we are in this moment, but kind of forever. We don't really think that it's going to change. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the culture, and I know this is off topic from your book, but of market research and just asking what I like and what I want and where that gets us. For in some ways, I'm about to talk about this at a TEDx talks next week, but to me, American taste comes down to this idea of me, not surprisingly, and mine, and my preference versus yours. Any thoughts about that?
I hadn't thought about it in any kind of systematic way, Mitchell, no. But I think that we're a Mad Men addicted family. We've been watching five seasons of Mad Men in 3 weeks, because having missed it in that weird way that happens. And one of the things that does strike me, if you watch, two things are happening in that period, the early 60s. One is that nobody really cares about food. They go out to expensive restaurants. They go to Lutèce, which is just open.
Interesting.
But they do it because it's where you go if you're a successful advertising executive. Not because, and nobody gets up and says, oh, let's not go to Lutèce. I don't like that place. What if we try this other place? It's just every restaurant is just coded socially. That's the right place to go or the wrong place to go. And women do the cooking, and they don't seem to enjoy it very much. Right. Men never cook. They just drink themselves into an anesthetized state. The other thing that's happening at the same time is market research is coming forward. Oh, you see them dealing with these advertising guys, are dealing with focus groups for the first time. Mm-hmm. What do you like? Why do you like it? And it's certainly true that that's where a lot of American taste comes from. We tend not, it's a complicated issue. On the whole, I think it's true that we tend to invent our tastes more than most other people do. That though we have continuities, I make my mother's rice pudding, I make my grandmother's sponge cake. On the whole, most of what I cook for my kids, I have learned to do in my own lifetime. I've made up for myself.
Right.
And as a consequence, we're self-conscious about it, I think, in a way that, I don't want to, sentimentalize French folks or Italian folks who are often doing similar kinds of things, but there usually is a kind of base of stuff I know, stuff that Mamie used to make, that is authentic, that actually is the case. And so I think that comes through. The other thing that strikes me, and this is an odd thing about market research, and it's one of the peculiarities about American life, is that we are puritanically health obsessed in a way that I don't think any other culture is quite as much. So pleasure is our last resort, saying it just tastes wonderful is sort of the last thing we say after we're saying it will improve your life, give you longer erections, give you better abs, and make the planet a safer place for your grandchildren to live on. We need to say all of those things before we can say, and it's completely delicious. Right. I make that point about the locavore movement, local eating, which I'm very sympathetic to, but I'm sympathetic to it because I think it's wonderful fun to know the person in Union Square who you're buying the strawberries or the chicken from and having a conversation. As my friend Peter Hoffman says, it puts a face on your food. Mm-hmm. And that in itself is terrific, whether or not, and we don't really know, whether or not we save 1,000 carbon feet by doing it.
Right. That's interesting. You do remind us in the book that eating in restaurants was once a place to find the exotic, where everything had to come from somewhere else, or it was, why would you would just eat? I mean, that would just be dinner, right?
Absolutely. I had fun in the course of doing this book. I went to the New York Public Library, which has an amazing collection of menus, all through time. And if you look at the menus of the classy places around 1910 in New York, Delmonico's and Luchow's and so on, what they put in a special bracket is not what just came in from the market today, but what we flew in from France. They weren't flying things in. What we got from France. As recently as 1980, there was a very stylish restaurant writer named Seymour Britschke, whose stuff I used to love to read, and gone now. When I first came to New York and we were living in a tiny basement room and we lived on a Papaya King hot dogs for a year, but I would read his stuff.
The best, though. The best of the cheap hot dogs.
Still, the filet mignon of hot dogs. I take my kids by that same stand, which is still there on Third Avenue. I say, I used to get every meal from there, and you're becoming a really crotchety old man. I would read Britschke. And one of the things I remember so clearly is that Britschke, writing about Lutèce maybe at that time, says as something, that, and they fly their soul in from France every day. Now, we would find that to be crazy.
Right.
That you would put a fish on an airplane and fly it all the way in and unpack it at Kennedy and bring it in, that that would be a sign of its excellence instead of a sign of its rottenness. We would think that's crazy. But as recently as 30 years ago, everyone took that for granted. The farther away something was sourced, the better it was likely to be.
That's where the value came from, its exoticism.
Exactly.
I think we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Adam Gopnik talking about taste.
I feel fine today, walking on cloud nine today. I'm over that line today, happiness is finally mine today. I guess I'm just a lucky guy, and here I'm about to tell you why. It's strictly on account of my sweet potato pie. The fella that she loves the most, the main reason why she left the coast. She's my little girl, senior, so much harder than a jalapeno. As tender as the night in June, sweeter than a honeymoon, brighter than a silver spoon, just about as crazy as
I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third-generation cure master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at surreyfarms.com or virginiatraditions.com.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and we are talking with Adam Gopnik, author of two new books, actually, one of which is The Table Comes First. And one of the things that I love that you do in the book, in fact, I it's funny that I've never seen anything quite like it, I think, is that you intersperse your chapters, your essays about various aspects of food and taste with emails about recipes and a conversation with Elizabeth Pinnell, I guess is her name.
Right. Yeah.
Could you explain to the listeners who she is?
Sure. Elizabeth Pinnell
was
I like to pretend is, right? Elizabeth Pinnell was a remarkable American-born but London-living writer of the late 19th century. She and her husband wrote a kind of standard biography of Whistler in that period. They were very much part of that circle, the Whistler Wild Estate circle. And she wrote for the Pall Mall Gazette a series of columns about food, which she called and collected to, and called The Diary of a Greedy Woman. And they're little narrative recipes. She was a great Francophile and a great lover of food. And what makes this book, which was published in 1900, so wonderful is that she is absolutely unapologetic about her appetite. She's not a woman who's saying, this is the way to make your family happy. There's not a hint of the domestic Chatelaine in anything she does. She's kind of Nigella Lawson before there was one. She's just a woman with this huge sensual appetite. And she's quite blunted about the relationship between food and sex and so on. I just thought this was amazing. Very stylish writer. And she had this way of giving recipes in a narrative rather than in a quantitative form. So I was hugely drawn to her. And I thought one of the things I wanted to do in the book is I was well aware that, and in a way that I'm proud of, it's a book of philosophy in some ways. It's about thinking about food and about writing about food and so on. But I never wanted to lose sight of the subject of food, which is food, which is the anchovy and bacon and cinnamon and saffron and everything else that's before us. I never wanted to lose that. So I was struggling, how could I write about the particulars of food in this context? And I thought, I'm going to write a series of letters to this Elizabeth Pinnell, this woman who died many, many years ago, and emails, because that's how we really write letters these days, and also they're more ethereal and appropriate for the dead, as though, and talking about the specific dish I'm making tonight, how I make it, why I love it, what problems it presents, and then compare those things with the particulars of her time 100 years ago, with the added little dollop of irony that here she was, a woman who had the courage to declare her appetite, to declare that she wasn't a good home cook, but she was a woman who wandered in the world devouring delicious things. And here I am, a man, a husband and father, who takes on the old feminine role of being the nightly cook, person who has right. to put an apron on, or I actually don't, but who should put an apron on so as not to spoil his clothes, and does the cooking every night. I thought there was a funny kind of irony in there. And it was a kind of breakthrough for me, because it meant that I found I could write about three ways of roasting a chicken or my three favorite ways of doing rice pudding without either seeming like a pro cook trying to give recipes, which I certainly am not, or but at the same time emphasizing the particulars. And as you know, what happened is I went on doing this, and with more and more sense of fun, as I made a very disturbing discovery about Elizabeth Pennell, which is, in plain English, that she was an anti-Semite. Very, not just an anti-Semite, which was sort of you expect in that period, but specifically that she had been raised in Philadelphia. And she went back to Philadelphia, which is where I was born, and the thing she hated were the Russian Jews who had invaded Philadelphia and begun to live on the beautiful tree-named streets, Spruce and Pine and Locust Street. Well, my family, the Kopniks, were Russian Jews who lived on Locust Street. It wasn't just that she disliked my kind in a general sense, which we accept historically. She hated my great-grandparents, really hated my great-grandparents specifically, probably saw them on the street, said, those are the people who are ruining America. And then the question comes to you, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you and I and people who love food, we love to talk easily about how the table reconciles opposites. It's the hearth of our lives. And we feel that, too. And it's one of the great pleasures of life when you're in a foreign country and you feel a little awkward or uncomfortable. We've all had this experience. And then you break bread with somebody. Mm-hmm. You sit down, you have something simple, plate of sausages and a glass of wine, and a human contact is made. It's one of the most fundamental human experiences. It's what Jesus was all about. Jesus was all about people, unlike people, sharing a common table. So we believe that, right? But there's a sentimental element to it. How far can you push that belief? Sure. Who will you dine with? Who won't you dine with?
What will ruin your appetite?
Who will ruin your appetite? Right. Who will ruin your appetite? Who will you say, I can't sit at this table with this person? Could I sit at this table with Elizabeth Pennell anymore, this woman who I had come to admire and I'd vented in some ways in my mind was a real person? And I thought that that gave the book at the end, I hoped that that gave the book at the end, a somewhat more serious note than I had anticipated.
Oh, for sure. And I mean, to what you said earlier, one of the things that drew you to her in the first place, I think, was that the food she described resonated with our tastes today. And so just as though when someone orders a certain thing, you know that they vote for Obama. What a shock.
Exactly. She has wonderful kind of Chez Panisse kind of taste, quite shocking at the time. She's not eating fancy stuff at the Café Royal. She loves a great roast chicken, great red Burgundy, fruit tarts, all the kind of stuff that we think is very much our taste now. Yeah, exactly.
While you're on your Mad Men marathon, I'm on a Downton Abbey marathon. Uh-huh. I watched six episodes into the wee night hours of the night last night. And it is funny to see the different... I mean, there it's obviously all about the presentation, the service, the things that go into it. There's food and there's a cook, but no one really cares. It's about what silver and how it's polished and all that sort of stuff. And presumably a few years later than even Pennell was writing.
Exactly. And I think she was in rebellion against, because living in England, where there was good food, certainly, but where it was all sort of a French import. And as you say, it was bounded around by all those kind of social constrictions and rules. There's a lovely moment in one of her books where she talks about this strange and wonderful thing that you will come to love too if you give it a chance. The Italians call it spaghetti. And she explains what spaghetti is, how you prepare it, how you do it.
And I will never love spaghetti.
Exactly. And it's exactly the same tone, you know, as one of our contemporary food writers coming back from, Turkmenistan and saying, you know, they do pig's ears there in a way. Just give them a chance and you will love it.
So, not to change the topic totally, but one of the things that strikes me, not just in this book, but in your writing about food in general, in the past, we like to equate this idea that food is about love, that, you know, it's about our grandmothers. Every press release you get from a chef opening a new restaurant is how he or she learned to cook at the side of someone, all this sort of stuff. But actually underlying much of your writing about food, I think, is the idea that food is really about sex. And I wonder if we could talk about that a little bit. We're not on, this is an internet radio station, so we're free to...
It's funny, Mitchell, people have said that, and I genuinely, my eyebrows go, because I wasn't aware of it as I was writing the book, how much sublimated eroticism apparently seeps through in my stuff. I think it's true. It's more true for a guy who cooks in a certain way, because what are you doing in effect? You're impressing a woman very often when you do that. I mean, maybe that's my own pathos, but certainly it was one of the ways I would court girls when I was in the girl courting phase, is by saying, let me cook you something. And I think that's a powerful thing to do.
Sure.
I also think it's generally true, just in a slightly more impersonal social way, that the first function that a restaurant has, and one of the things that makes a restaurant different from all the other kind of eating establishments that we find in the world, is that it's a place of courtship. Mm-hmm. I mean, what's the first thing we do when we say, when we meet somebody we're interested in, man to man, woman to woman, man to woman, is we say, let's have dinner. It's the place, and we go to a nice restaurant, and we share a dinner, and that's where we begin to see if we're shaped alike, if our moral tastes coincide, and specifically if our erotic tastes are likely to overlap. That's one of the things that made the restaurant, when it was invented in France in the late 18th century, so remarkable. It was a place where men and women could go together, and where you could play out that wonderful theater of flirtation. So I think that certainly built into eating out is an idea of sex. Mm-hmm. And it's like dance, right? There's, no matter how formal dance becomes, dance is about sex. If it's any good. And I think that food is in the same way, no matter how formal it becomes, is about that. And, you know, one of the funny things, I've never thought about this before, is that we have a form of kind of false courtship. Very often, if you're a reporter or write about food as you do, you know, you go to a restaurant with somebody who you don't really know well, and you have a great meal together, and there's like this little erotic cloud that hangs over the table, and you sort of want to dispel it because it's not about that. You're not courting that person, and yet you can't avoid it in a way. It's part of the occasion. So yeah, I do think that almost all of our out eating, all of our restaurant eating, has a powerful romantic and erotic charge to it. It ought to. That's part of what makes it interesting. And even at home, I think one of the things that we do, I mean, at least for me, one of the simplest ways you can make up a quarrel, you can remind your spouse of your feelings, is to cook them that thing that they love. And I think so. I think that food and sex are inextricably linked, and we would be doing both an injustice by not
by separating them. Right.
By separating them.
Fantastic. So let's talk. What you communicate among all of the philosophical musings about food to Elizabeth Pennell are some of the combinations of flavors that you think you've discovered necessarily, but have become
love,
you love, that resonate. Let's talk about some of them, just because I think this is a show about taste, and we don't talk about food enough. Yeah.
Right. Let me think of some of the ones I have. I love bacon and anchovies. For me, bacon and anchovies. Uh-huh. Now, I'm from a Jewish background, so maybe the gust of sinning is tied to that too, at least with the bacon. I love those two flavors. When I'm cooking, I can't. There's very rarely anything with anchovies or bacon in it that I don't like. And they're that strong salt taste, that umami taste, and I just love it. And I give a recipe in the book for my simple leg of lamb just done with bacon. It's a classic French thing, is you put slits in the leg of lamb and as you go and you stuff anchovies in it, but I never could get enough anchovy flavor out of that. So instead I just lay those nice white anchovies, Italian anchovies, on top of the thing for the last 20 minutes of cooking, and it creates this wonderful kind of goo in the bottom of the roasting pan. You finish it with a little bit of why can't I think of the word, Mitchell, for what you, when you put wine in a pan?
Deglaze
the pan. Thank you. With a little bit of white wine, or if you happen to have it, a little flat champagne, and it's a makes for a fabulously good lamb thing. So I love those flavors. I love the sweet dark spices that you now find in North Africa, though they were originally the spices of the antique world, cloves and cinnamon and all of those kinds of things that were really banished by the great French cooks of the 19th century from our main courses, that were banished to punch and
dessert.
But I love those things. I love North African cooking as a consequence. So anything with saffron and cinnamon and a clove and garam masala, all of those things I just love. And try to use rose water is something that I always think is a lovely thing to finish a dish
in with. Reading you describe them, it struck me that the French are so famous for their perfumes and for scents, and yet their food is not very perfumey.
No, that's a very good point. That's a very good point. I have said this a million times, but it's really true. If I were a young chef in France, I would take, what's the natural, sort of the real national dish of France now is not pot-au-feu, it's couscous. That's what people eat.
Right.
Families, you know, middle class families eat when they go out on
Friday
night.
Comes out with the sparklers in it.
Exactly,
sometimes, yeah.
Exactly. And that's what people eat. So I would take that, North African cooking, Maghrebian cooking as they call it in France, mm-hmm. and try to take it to the next level. And I think that that would be, I know people are trying to do that, and that would be great. So I love those kinds of dark and musky mm-hmm. Spices. I love doing tagines and things. And then finally, I guess I, as I write in the thing, I am a deep skeptic about new wave desserts. I admire a great deal the guys in Barcelona and elsewhere here mm-hmm. in New York at Wiley Dufresne's who do those things. You know the kind of thing. I mean, mm-hmm. you have six different elements coming together on the plate. You know.
And many of them savory, not
exactly.
never sweet enough.
Never
somehow.
Sweet enough. You know, salt marshmallow with a gel of raspberry
right.
foam
and seaweed.
An oyster,
right.
seaweed, and all of that. I understand it. I grasp it aesthetically. I don't care for it. I love simple desserts. I love rice pudding or a chocolate cake or a souffle. I like those kinds of things. So I try to. Those are my finishing tastes tend to be, I guess, a bit regressive. I don't, but I think appropriately so because I think that you know a good meal is composed like a piece of music, and you want the last movement to return to the tonality of the, of
right.
the beginning.
So we're going to talk, we have just a few minutes left, and I the end of the book is really the pursuit of this question. You mentioned Spain now, about what happened to France or what's happening in France, did Spain usurp France? Is Norway, I mean Denmark, I should say,
right.
the new Nordic cuisine taking over? What was your conclusion about that, and what do you think? I mean, it certainly hasn't changed your opinion of wanting to go eat anywhere you can in Paris.
No,
but
I'm not even a Francophile, I'm a Parisophile. I love Paris, and I'll always be happy eating there. I think it's true, and I wrote this many years ago and got a lot of flack in France for it, that French cooking, the dominance of French cooking, has been in a kind of crisis for a while. And any intelligent French gastronome you talk to, my friend Benedict Bourget, mm-hmm. a friend of both of us, says it. They know it. They recognize it. And then there are all these various reform movements, like my slightly eccentric friends in the fooding movement, who are trying to sort of, in a certain way, Americanize French food, just at least, you know, we love slow food. We believe in slow food. We're members of the slow food movement. They've had slow food up the wazoo.
Right.
They never want anything slow again. They want good food, but they want fast food. They want, you know, they love places like Momofuku, right? Because you
right.
sit at the counter and you ask for something and they bring it to you and you don't have to go through that whole pseudo-erotic rigmarole of the mm-hmm. French restaurant. So I think that that's true. And anybody who's eaten or was lucky enough, as I did once, you did at El Bulli, knows something was going on. And you can feel, at least I feel, when I go and eat in fancy places in Paris now, that those guys don't know what to do about mm-hmm. it. So you'll get a foam or a gel on your plate. Doesn't really belong there, but they recognize that cooking is changing and how do you handle it? I believe that the sort of the inner resources of France are so enormous mm-hmm. when it comes to food, both in the simplest sense. There's so much good food in France, so much good
ingredients,
so many beautiful right. ingredients that you can't miss. And I think more and more you're beginning to see that stuff is coming forward. You know, good eating in France for a very long time was associated with middle-aged guys who voted for right-wing parties. You know, that was the classic model of the gastronome. And as that alters and it becomes younger and more, you know, talking about the eroticism of food, it's startling that the people in the fooding movement, men and women both, tend to be very attractive. Mm-hmm. And I asked the organizer, Alexandre, about that once, and I said, you know, have you noticed you got incredibly beautiful women in this? And he said, yes, that's quite deliberate. He said, we're trying to break the cliche of the 50-year-old man with three chins and
right,
a napkin.
And, right.
and a napkin. That's what French food cooking has looked like to French people.
That's the interesting part, right. It's not just the caricature outside of France.
No,
right.
to French people for a long time, and they want to escape it. So you know, look, we're also all prisoners of our taste. I don't want to go to Paris. When I go to Paris, I want to eat at Chez René or at,
right.
at the Balzar, if it were still. And I want those experiences. You want those experiences. We don't want Paris or
to
France.
To be some modern food place.
Exactly.
Right,
we don't want to go to Momofuku in Paris necessarily.
Right.
And yet, in order for French cooking to renew itself, it has to change. It has to alter. So that's so much true about France writ large as well. You have a beautiful, secure, ongoing culture that can't just be perpetuated endlessly, or we'll be living in Venice. That's that's a real problem.
And it'll sing. Well,
yes.
Can't thank you enough for joining us here in Brooklyn. Adam Gopnik, his latest book is The Table Comes First. Actually, it's one of the latest books. The other book is on winter.
Winter. It's a kind of cultural history of winter. It's a series of lectures I did up in Canada. But anybody who's curious about cold weather, I hope will enjoy it. Six Ways of Being Cold.
Six Ways of Being Cold and One Way of Being Full and Satisfied.
Exactly.
You're listening to Taste Matters. Next Wednesday, we will have Allison Cave, who had the funny trajectory of having won a pie contest in Brooklyn and then suddenly started a pie business, even though she had a background in art and worked in galleries all her life. And so we'll hear about that transition and the life of a first prize pie maker with Allison Cave. You can download the show on iTunes as a podcast or listen in our archives on heritageradionetwork.com. Thanks.
Wonderful. Thank you, Mitch.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.